This episode of UK Low Carb Podcast is sponsored by Deliciously Guilt-Free. Enjoy the show.
I have fallen still driving and driven off the road. And the only reason I didn't kill myself or anybody else, sheer chance, there just happened to not be
just
a person or a tree there. I mean, if there was, I wouldn't be here talking to you right now, period.
What I have learned over the past 2 years has been magnificent. You know, it's completely changed my life.
And so you're not going to die if you don't eat carbohydrates, but you will die if you don't eat fat and protein.
The energy I have, the life I have that has changed so amazingly in a few years, proves to me that what I'm eating is only doing me good.
You know what? I'd love to meet them because they changed my life, basically.
So I've lost now. I'm just a couple of, I'm about 3 pounds off losing 5 stone.
Hello and welcome to UK Low Carb. This is your podcast, the podcast where we share the real life stories and experiences of people like you and me, people who follow the low carb or keto diet. So join me, Dan Grief, and my co-host each Friday to hear their story. And if you'd like to get involved, then please email me, dan@uklowcarb.com, or join our growing Facebook group, UK Low Carb. And finally, please rate and review this podcast on Apple Podcasts so that we can get the message out about the amazing benefits of the low-carb and keto lifestyle. Now, this podcast is sponsored by my business, Deliciously Guilt-Free. Just use the code PODCAST and you can have 20% off your order. On with the show! Hello and welcome to another episode of UK Low Carb. I'm so pleased you're listening or watching this on YouTube at the moment. Just to let you know a bit about me and this podcast. So my name is Dan Grief. I'm your host of the show. And this show is all about sharing people's stories to help build up the keto and low carb community, not just in the UK, but also around the world. And I truly believe that we as individuals can be the change we want to see in the world. Now, today's show is particularly poignant to that message because I'm talking to Dan Wiseman, who I know many of you all know from Twitter. He's known as @steakandiron. That's his Twitter handle. He's quite a spiky character on Twitter. I think he's great because he really engages with people and was not afraid of a debate or a discussion. He's always respectful and polite, but he's very good at expressing what he thinks. I think that's great to have on the show. And I'll just tell you quickly how I came across him. So it was through Twitter. A good friend of mine, Chris Rooney, who I know many of you know from being on the podcast himself, actually retweeted one of his tweets. And it was where he was in a supermarket and he was describing how the people behind him had a basket full of what looked like low carb and keto food. He then described how this was a really special day in their lives, how they were making this change, and it was going to be great to see in a few years from now where they'll be. But this is the first step in that journey. And I thought that was really inspiring. So I got in touch with him. We had a bit of a debate about his politics. He's an anarchist, and I'm a social democrat stroke sort of democratic socialist. So I thought this is going to be an interesting podcast from that point of view. Now, what we discussed on this show, which I think you'll find quite interesting, was his own story. I didn't want to focus too much on that because I know that he's shared that on other podcasts. So I decided to also talk about the health crisis we're in, a bit about the food industry, about animal welfare, a bit about evolution and how it is that we've come to eat the foods we do at the moment, what works for us. The Unequal One stories, which are so powerful, and spreading those stories, get it out there to everyone. And then we ended the show about ideological philosophy. Now, Dan said to me he had 90 minutes in which he was able to give me some time. So I want to apologize to him now because I pretty much took 89 minutes of that time and then did the last minute for sort of summing up. So this show is going to be really interesting. We talk about politics, about how we find a solution to the crisis we're in, comparing our countries and the problems we have as well. But also he shares his own points of view. I honestly think that this guy should have his own podcast. I told him that as well. And I would love him to come back on. So if you're listening to this, Dan, you've got an open invitation. Whenever you want to come back on, you're more than welcome here. And if you want to do a series together, then please get in touch because I'd really love that. Right. I think that's about it then. I wish everyone a very happy weekend, whatever you're up to. And I will see you all next week. And I'll hand over to Dan Wiseman, aka @steakandiron. Hi guys, welcome back to another episode of UK Low Carb. And I am so privileged today because I'm talking to another Dan, and that's Dan Wiseman. Now, it's going to be pretty obvious early on that he's the intelligent one and the cool one because he's American. So, you know, he does outshine me a little bit here. You may know him from his Twitter account because he's Steak and Iron. Welcome to UK Low Carb, Dan.
Hey, thanks for having me, Dan. Us Dan's got to stick together, you know.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. We're our own little tribe, aren't we?
Yes, we are.
So the way that I came across you was through Twitter, and it's because Chris Rooney, who was on the show last week, and by the time people listen to this, it'll be in a couple of weeks from then, and he retweeted something that I thought was really sweet, and it's where you were in a supermarket, you came across, I think it was a couple who you said, I'm trying to paraphrase this, they looked like they were trying to change their lives to keto, and you were saying what a wonderful, positive thing this was. And then Chris said, you don't mind me saying this, he said, do they realize they're in contact with keto royalty, albeit, you know, like a distant cousin of the family or whatever? And I thought, who is this guy? This is amazing. And I read your Twitter profile and I was like, God, this guy's got a hell of a personality. So that's why I wanted you on the show.
I've got a perspective. You can kind of leave it at that. Yeah. I like seeing people, experiment with this lifestyle because I had to find health my own way. And what I eventually decided to do with the whole low carb path that I went on was very strange for people to do when I started doing it. And I started, keto in about 2010, and nobody knew what it was back then. I was the weird guy who didn't eat French fries and or bread or, fruit or these things that are obviously healthy. And they got a lot of health from that. And now it's fun because I get to see these people who are, keto products in the store. Some are good, some are bad. I don't know about, if keto candy bars are really the best thing for people to be eating. But I saw this couple that were behind me. They were young. They were younger than I was when I started my journey. They were both, definitely had some weight to lose. But they just had a great cart full of, nice, whole, healthy food. And they were talking about it and how they're going to do this and, what are carbs? I mean, it sounded like they're very, very new to the idea of this and they're going to give it a shot. And I just felt really happy for them that they were good. They were already making this change early in life. When so many people, they wait another 40, 50 years old. They're already, already starting to have problems. You can tell your doctor's talking about, you got to get on this medication or whatever. You catch these things early and you can have a really, really good life ahead of you. And it just made me happy to see that.
I love that. And it's so positive. Now, the one thing with you, though, Dan, is that when someone sees you now, you look like a really fit, healthy guy. But it wasn't always that way, was it? And I think, hey, there we go. He's getting the guns out. For anyone who's listening to this episode, he's got his guns out there. Anyway, so he's basically a fit, healthy looking guy. But it wasn't always that way, was it? And I think the fact that you have at such a young age come to keto is pretty much through desperation. Would you say keto was almost like the last thing through an act of desperation to try?
In a lot of ways, yeah. Because I was heavy. I was probably at my heaviest, 250 pounds, which is 120 kilos, whatever that ends up being. And I'm 5'9". I'm not a tall guy. I didn't wear it well. It was very much all in the belly. And, I just was by any measure unhealthy. I would get things like nosebleeds and backaches and, my hands would swell up and, I wasn't sleeping well. I'd fall asleep while driving and all these kind of crazy things were just happening to me. Wow. And it was clear to me that just something was very wrong. I was getting problems that are not necessarily uncommon, as well, but they were happening to me at a much younger age than you would expect them to happen. I'm on blood thinners. I have a clotting mutation.
Are we talking about? Because you're only young now. So what were you when you're suffering from this metabolic condition?
So I'm 36 now, and this would have been in my early to mid-20s. And things really kind of fell off for me in terms of at least visual physical health in my college years because I just didn't focus on anything other than my work and my studies. And everything else, health, diet, any kind of exercise, whatever, it just didn't happen because I literally had no time to do it. I was eating whatever I could afford or whatever I could scrounge up, which was all garbage. I mean, it was very, very often just, grains and sugars and ice cream and cheese and everything else I could get my hands on that would just happen to be on clearance. Or literally being thrown away. I was getting food from the local coffee shop that was throwing out the breakfast muffins and whatever at the end of the day, just so that I have food in my fridge. And, you know, that was, for one, it made me pretty tough. You know, it makes me realize that if the you know what hits the fan, I'm going to be okay because I've actually dealt with that before, whereas a lot of my trust fund friends would be completely screwed. But, you know, at the end of college, I was, you know, highly marketable, but not very healthy, right? So I needed to figure out how to fix it. And I tried a lot of different things. And I tried just counting calories, which of course works. I mean, but it's not sustainable for me because I was always hungry and I was always tired.
Well, who isn't? I mean, actually, and also counting calories, I mean, that's the sort of predominant diet industry standard, you know, way of losing weight. But I don't know anybody who's, okay, you might have had success with that diet, but then it seems to be people put the weight back on plus some. So, you know, does anyone ever say, oh, I did that diet and I've been healthy for 20 years afterwards without any problems? I don't think anyone is, are they?
Not really. And there's also this built-in mindset that if you're counting calories, you're not making necessarily changes to what you're eating. You're just eating less of it, which means you're going to be hungry. Yeah. And you're also looking at it probably from a time-restricted standpoint. No, I'm going to eat this until, you know, swimsuit season, and I'm going to go back to eating everything else that I did before.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think that everybody who's obese, and you know, I was pretty squarely in the obese category, has lost weight. I mean, they've all lost, you know, 10, 15, 20 pounds. It just comes back. And, you know, when I found keto, I found people talking about it and talking about low carb things. And we had the Atkins craze maybe a decade before that. And I saw this kind of sounds like the Atkins stuff, but they were saying, oh, you know, I lost all this weight and I wasn't hungry, which is weird because I'm always hungry, and I wasn't tired. And I'm like, I'm always tired. So maybe I'll give this a try. And I mean, just overnight, within a month, I was down 10 or 15 pounds easily. My clothes were fitting better. I started working out a little bit before then, but I wasn't enjoying it. I began to enjoy my workouts because I began to have enough energy to complete the workouts. I mean, within that first month, I was already not having any kind of issues with energy, you know, being able to drive home after work. I've always had a very long commute. I live in Northern California. It just kind of comes with the territory. Right. And I was fine. And I just kind of thought, wow, this is really cool. I hope it's not going to give me a heart attack, but maybe if it does, I'll leave a pretty corpse. So that was kind of like my thought process at the time. And, you know, I came to learning a little bit more about it. And I'm pretty sure that, you know, foods that we've been eating for the last, you know, few million years are not the cause of diseases that we only started getting in the last 150 years, but it's all debatable. But I can't point to any part of my health that has not improved dramatically since I started just eating a lot of meat, some vegetables, not fearing things like fat and cholesterol in my diet, and eating as much really as I want without counting it. Not even eating as much as I can, because I can eat just an absolutely ridiculous amount of food. But I can now stop eating, which is something I could not do before. You know, I can say, oh, that's good. Have a little bit of that. And I'll put the rest in the fridge for tomorrow or whatever the case may be. Whereas, you know, the old thing was, you know, eat it till it's gone.
Yeah.
And that was very new. That's exciting. You know, not being hungry when you've been hungry your whole life is liberating. It's free.
It is incredible, isn't it? And actually, it sounds like you've had the same experience like most of us, and I certainly can relate to this, whereby you don't really understand how you work. And then suddenly when you do keto or you just cut back on your carbs and your sugar, you're saying like, oh my goodness, that food has that reaction. I didn't realize. I thought hunger was just part of life. I didn't realize that actually it goes away when I only eat steak and I don't eat the sort of, you know, candy bars, et cetera. And I think the understanding yourself is huge. But in your case, I mean, without going putting too fine a point on it, when you were younger and you're like mid-20s, is it right that you not only had a weight issue, but actually also had, is it a dental issue that you had, your eyes? I mean, you were quite seriously ill. I mean, you're falling asleep when you're driving. That's incredible.
I have fallen asleep while driving and driven off the road. And the only reason I didn't kill myself or anybody else, sheer chance, or just happened to not be
just luck.
A person or a tree there. I mean, if there was, I wouldn't be here talking to you right now, period.
Yeah,
I mean, absolutely.
Yeah, sure.
I drove into I drove into a construction ditch, blew all four tires in my car, all four tires of the car.
Whoa.
Gone, all four rims dented, needed to be replaced. Jeez. I was okay, luckily. But I mean, if that was just a, you know, more than just a ditch, if say a bulldozer was still there or they were doing the road work, I would have hit that.
Yeah.
Boom.
Yeah.
I used to drive a lot. This was a Mazda Miata I was driving at the time, which if you hit anything in that, you lose, right? This is a little teeny tiny car. So, Yeah, I've got my eyes. I've got cataracts in my eyes that I had recently, somewhat recently, over the last 5 years replaced. So everything basically you can see inside the blue there is all artificial. I am one of the first, one of the youngest people in California to get a new generation of artificial lens put in my eyes, which is cool. Went from legally blind in one eye to 20/20 vision, which was super cool. In a day, which is just like blows my mind that that technology even exists.
And why did it happen that you lost your eyesight in the first place? It's the food on your fork at the time, right?
I have to imagine. When I was talking to my doctor about it, he was looking at it and he's like, "You know, what I'm seeing is not uncommon. It's very uncommon with somebody of your age." Mm. And you know, I also look at everything else that's happened to me. Like I said, my blood clotting disorder. It's a very common disorder that I have. It's a particular mutation called prothrombin 2, but it doesn't normally start causing issues in people until they're in their 60s and 70s.
Right.
And I had a blood clot in my lung that I was hospitalized for. Actually, two of them in my 20s.
And your lung was really dangerous.
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah. It was real nasty. They said that basically, if I just ignored it, I could have lost my lung.
Yeah.
Or you know, could get dislodged and up your brain. All kinds of crazy stuff happened. Actually, it was so bad. I thought I got shot. Like there was like a wayward bullet or something hit me in the middle of the night. I was in so much pain, like looking for blood. I ended up getting to the hospital, and they're like, "No, yeah, it's a blood clot. Hit you with the blood thinners. Don't shave for a few days because if you cut your face, it'll just keep bleeding." Then they got me on some pills for life. But
so trying keto, really, like you say, you know, what's to lose? You know,
you said
might just die a bit earlier of a heart attack, but compared to all those things already in your early 20s, you really don't have much to lose in comparison.
Incredible. Exactly. Yeah. If my body's going to try to kill me, I might as well have everything I put in my body be at least, you know, try to offset it. So, you know, it's all about balance, right?
I guess so. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
What about your family? Do they have these sort of metabolic conditions, or you know, I don't know if they do low carb or keto now, but do they have similar health problems? And is it a genetic thing, or are you just particularly unlucky?
My on my dad's side was a lot of smokers and overweight people. My dad actually died before I was born, so I never met him. It was my biological father. I was raised by an amazing man that I call my dad. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there was a lot of, they all died fairly young, of, the heart attacks and strokes and things like that. On my mom's side, not so much, that I can really tell, some cancer, a lot of dental problems on that side, which I seem to have avoided. No, not really. I think that a lot of it was just more or less environmental. A couple of maybe small little genetic factors that maybe accelerated a few things, but I had just put myself into a very unhealthy environment and my body was not able to deal with the load I was putting on it. You know, we can also put on top of all that, you know, obviously I was not sleeping. I was, you know, not, you know, probably not drinking enough water. I was living off of energy drinks and everything just to have who knows what the hell is in those, right?
Definitely.
I was basically packing myself full of chemicals and not getting any sleep, trying to survive college. And she did. I came out the other side of it, but
survive. I mean, it seems like it's hit and miss for a while there, to be fair.
Yeah, there's about a 50-50 chance there for a good long while. I came out the other side. I have an amazing life now, and I'm really glad that I you know found this way to help because it gave me you know more energy. It gave me more drive, more focus. It got me into a better job than I had at the time. I got what I believe. The sort of focus and energy to get the amazing wife that I have now and I have the amazing family that I have now. And I just don't think that I could actually do the things that I do now if I had never achieved the kind of health that I did by switching what I ate.
Yeah, yeah. Well, in that case, before we go into what you're eating now, and I know there's so much I want to go through with you, so let's get this stuff done early on in the show. But I want to talk just about how you saw yourself, because you know, especially in your early 20s, it's really a period in many people's lives where they're just discovering themselves, and actually, you know, you can be very self-aware in the teenage years into early 20s about how the world sees you. So if you're somebody who is, you know, like heavier than you'd wish to be with all these health things, and then suddenly, you know, you're losing weight, you're looking better, and you said you met your wife, etc. You know, how was your confidence levels, and how did you sort of see, what was your value, your self-value at that point as you made the transition?
I mean, it definitely went up, for sure. I was always very extroverted, and always very kind of like jovial, but, you know, I look back and I want to say, how much of that was an act, really? Sometimes it was a bit, you know, I was playing a character in a lot of ways because it was what expected of me.
Don't we all that age to some extent? I think that's quite common, isn't it? But,
yeah,
you know, the way people see us, we become almost like a slight mirror image of what we get seen as, and we like it, so we play up to it. You know, it's very normal, yeah, I think.
Exactly. But I mean, I also developed a lot of social skills and stuff by being a social person. And then when I had, you know, an actual, you know, appearance and energy level that I was happy with and confidence level that I was happy with, I already had these skills. And I love being out with people and meeting people and talking to people. And, you know, now it doesn't feel like I'm necessarily on stage playing a character. It's really just, it's who I am now. And, It's cool. It's also been this weird transformation of seeing myself go from the jolly nerdy fat guy to being the guy who knows about nutrition and fitness.
Yeah.
And especially when I don't necessarily, you know, that's not necessarily the person who lives in my head. Especially, you know, if I look at like pictures and videos, I go, huh, that's me. You know, even though I haven't looked like, you know, I used to for almost a decade now, I look at photos of myself and I go, huh, that's what I look like, huh? I don't know.
That's great. Weird.
Yeah,
it
makes me wonder if is that ever actually going to like click at any point? I'm not going to have the fat guy in my head.
You are the polar opposite from like many people in society. Most people in their 20s don't really have much to worry about. And then they look back at themselves in their 40s and they go, what happened? You know, they catch themselves in the mirror and go, that's me. I used to be this fit, young, healthy guy. You're the other way around. You're like, I was on my knees at 24 and now look at me, you know?
Yeah. No, I do feel like, you know, who knows? My 40s are coming up. Maybe I'll just descend into dad bod and, you know, with the cargo shorts and the New Balance sneakers and the tucked in polo shirt. Maybe it'll happen. Who knows? I don't know.
Right. You got to stop there. I turned 40 this year and I have one of those things became true for me in the last week. So let's leave.
Oh, dear. Well, best of luck.
Moving on. So let's talk about your food now then. So, what is your kind of, you know, roughly what are you eating? And also, how do you keep it interesting and not a bit monotonous? Because some people can be really strict on keto, and I find that kills me. I'm like, geez, I need more than just steak. You know, I need some flavor. So what do you do to try and keep it all spiced up, maybe literally or metaphorically?
So my philosophy basically now that meat is the food and then everything that you go with the meat is to make the meat more enjoyable.
Yep.
So I had to learn how to cook when I was broke in college. So I even just buying prepared foods or going to fast food restaurants, more than I could afford. I couldn't afford to go to McDonald's. So I had to learn how to cook at least to some level. And the food I could afford was not necessarily great food. So I had to figure out how to make it taste good.
Yeah.
So I had a bunch of cookbooks. I'd go to the thrift stores and I'd buy these cookbooks. And I'd learn to cook different kinds of cuisines from all over the world because I found it interesting. You know, what makes Italian food taste like Italian food? What makes, you know, Greek food taste like Greek food? And what makes, you know, whatever kind of food taste like whatever kind of food? And there's different, you know, spices and flavor combinations, sauces that kind of just become part of, you know, the background, the way I cook. So taking that and moving it into my lifestyle that I have now is I will usually do something like make a big batch cook just for, you know, convenience sake of a meat, maybe a big pork shoulder, maybe a big chuck roast, maybe a big, you know, a couple of chickens. That'll last me and the family for several days. And I'll make different spice mixes or dressings or sauces or things that can go on it. And, you know, when I cook it, very, very neutral, maybe just salt, pepper, garlic, whatever. And then, you know, when it comes time to finish it, I either have a vegetable that's you know, got some different, you know, oregano and basil on it, and now it's Italian kind of flavor to it, and then put that together. So when you have these different meats, different cuts of meat, different vegetables, and these different spices, you can combine them in a lot of different ways and really not eat the same meal twice for a long time. So
that's good.
Yeah, that's just, I think the easiest way to do it. I think that diets fail for a lot of people when they become too complicated. It's about having this balance of enough variety, but you know, you can't be spending 2 hours making dinner every night. So there needs to be sort of like this, you know, this balance and being able to
find some hacks to make it possible and, you know, logistical without it like being boring or monotonous. Yeah,
exactly. And using technology to your advantage. You know, if you get a pressure cooker, if you get a slow cooker, that kind of stuff, you can do a lot of cooking and make it taste very good in a very short period of time, at least in terms of like your actual input into dinner.
You have to be there the whole time. Yeah. I agree. Yeah, love that. Mm-hmm. So meat predominantly, and I mean, do you favor any particular meat? Because I personally kind of go more towards the beef and sometimes lamb. I don't really do pork. I mean, is there any particular meats you go for? Is there any you try to avoid at all?
I don't necessarily try to avoid any. I really like beef. My wife is not a big fan of beef. So, you know, beef is more like a special occasion kind of thing. But you know, chicken, pork, are primarily what we do in the house. The kid likes them. So it's easy enough to make something that, that my little 2-year-old will enjoy as well. I think that, you know, it's, you know, easy to, you know, learn a few things to do with these different cuts of meat and make them taste good. And then you can have these special, you know, fancy steaks or fancy roasts or whatever, special occasions. And I'd like to do more lamb. Lamb's not really as common around here as it is across the pond there, but
well, I didn't know that. Okay. It's not as accessible then. It's probably more expensive than I thought.
It's quite, if you can find it, it's about as expensive as very, very good beef. And
okay,
most of the time, the beef will probably just make more sense. But yeah, I've done a couple of like lamb roasts and stuff in my day, and I'm a big fan of it. It's good.
Yeah.
But yeah, just, I usually buy what's on sale, buy it in bulk, butcher it myself, you know, buy a whole cut of, you know, pork or like several whole chickens, butterfly myself, and cook them up. And, you know, it works out well.
Fantastic. Mm-hmm. So I did promise you that this wouldn't just be about your food and about just about steak and eggs and whatnot. I really want to pick your brain about some topics, if that's okay.
And, yeah, sure.
Yeah, because you got so much I can learn from you. And there's one thing in particular I want to talk about, and that's the health crisis we're in now. Because, you know, I think it's fair to say that when you describe your story, you're not doing anything that unusual compared to many, many people in the world today. I mean, especially younger people, maybe. The fact you're like, you know, you have to survive on pretty much carbs and sugar, and you said about energy drinks. Well, I used to be a teacher, and I remember a kid turning up to school with an energy drink, and I was like, "You having breakfast?" And he's like, "This is breakfast," and he'd neck it, and then, you know, he'd be like having his crash by 10 in the morning. And but, you know, but the sad reality is, you know, he is. Okay, it's a bit of an outlier, but there are many kids who are doing that. So, you know, this is happening. And if you see in the US and Europe, and also, you know, anywhere in the Western world where, well, in the world where they're eating the Western diet, clearly there's a massive increase in obesity and type 2 diabetes. So my question is, you know, in your opinion, is that, do you think, mainly sugar, or is it carbs? Is it seed oils? Is it a combination of all of them? Or is it also something to do with not just nutrition, but potentially, you know, the way that we're interacting and the way that we're living our lives now and the environment's changed, that all these factors are making us sick?
I think it's a sort of a perfect storm of a lot of different things, because you could look at different kinds of studies, and you look at these things where you take people and you lock them in a room and you put a big pile of food of different kinds in front of them, and how do they behave? You know, these buffet effects or whatever. And a couple things will make people eat more. Stress makes people eat more. People are generally more stressed now. Yeah. High palatability food is going to make people eat more. So more sugar, more fat makes people eat more. Low protein makes people eat more, because there's kind of a base level of protein.
Oh, yeah, of course. You need to get more protein in, don't you? So then your body craves food to get more protein. It makes sense, yeah.
Exactly. And, you know, the Ted Naiman theory about the protein leverage hypothesis, I don't think it's complete, but I think it's part of the story that, you know, we were eating something like 25% of our calories from protein. Now it's something like 12 to 13%. And, I mean, it makes sense, because you can make energy from anything. You can make it from sugar. You make it from fat. You really can't make your own protein. So you need to get it somehow. And I don't think bodies are stupid. I mean, we are apex predators. We are the most dangerous thing that this planet has ever produced. And it's made dinosaurs and shit, right? Dinosaurs didn't dinosaurs didn't get together and say, we need to stop killing everything, otherwise it's all going to be gone. We are the people that have to like stick together and say, we need to stop, you know, fishing the ocean is completely empty, right? We need to figure this out. So, where was I going with that? you know, we have these this environment overall that has created an unusual problem where we've got all these these foods that are hyper palatable, they're low in protein, they're extremely high novelty. You know, there's what's called the buffet effect, where you have all these different foods all at once, and your body doesn't say stop until really you've had a little bit of everything, right?
Yeah.
And you always have the buffet effect right now, because you have such a tremendous variety of foods available to you at all times. Now, I can go to the supermarket right now. I can go to the supermarket in the middle of December and buy a pineapple for like $3. kings could not do that stuff.
I know you're a big fan of history, and I remember reading recently how here in the UK there are buildings where you see from like the early 19th century and early late 18th century where pineapples were a key part of buildings, and you can actually see in stately homes a golden pineapple on the table because the golden pineapple is actually cheaper than an actual pineapple, and they wanted to represent how posh or rich they were, and then people would actually go around with a pineapple and not actually eat the thing, just showing off they've got one because they didn't have one. And now you just get a can out and it's got, you know, like a sugary syrup sauce in there, pineapple galore. You could have that for every meal of the day, couldn't you? And not have to worry about what season or what part of the world you're in.
No, there's no seasonality. 24/7. Yeah, there's no seasonality of any kind of food, right? This is like you say, oh, the apple season. Okay, maybe you're buying locally, but I mean, at what point can you go to the store and not buy apples or cherries or, nectarines or any of these things that are normally, I mean, I had an apricot tree in my backyard growing up. You'd have about 3 weeks where you just have apricots falling on the ground. Constantly.
Then you're sick of them at the end of that period.
And you look for them
in a year's time, Yeah,
exactly. And we were into like canning or making jams or anything like that. We'd eat the apricots when they were fresh off the tree, and then eventually we'd just have a big pile of rotten apricots all over the ground. And then, we didn't see an apricot off that tree for another year. And that's how fruit actually works. And like, that's how the actual function of fruit is. You get this big, drop of fruit, all the birds and squirrels and stuff pile on it, spread out the seeds, and then nature does its thing. And so there's the idea that, you'd have access to this sort of food for a very short period of time. But right now you've got this tremendous variety at all times, and you have these foods that I'd say probably mimic, very rare foods in nature. There was somebody asked me what in nature actually has a lot of sugar and a lot of fat in it? Like, what is nature's cheesecake? And it's human breast milk. It's the only thing that you'd ever actually encounter that has a lot of sugar and fat in it. And what does milk do in nature? Milk is to make animals grow. And if you're already like past puberty, what do you don't grow up anymore? You grow out. So when you're looking at high sugar and fat combination things, I figure that's all your body knows how to do at that point. It's just, okay, let's prepare for the winter that never comes.
Yeah. But you know what? There's millions of years of evolution. I want to go into evolution with you, but there's millions of years of evolution that go into the fact we're having this conversation today. It's incredible. We take so much for granted. But you said there about the foods we're eating. I mean, the food industry is only concerned with the money in your pocket. It doesn't give a damn about anything else. And it sure doesn't care about the cost to your health. I mean, in the States, of course, you pay for healthcare or you have insurance. And, you probably see more directly how much it costs for things. In the UK, I think we're a little bit blinded to that sometimes because we don't pay for ourselves, although we do pay it as taxpayers, of course. And I think, the food industry is taking that money from us, and then it's literally making a flavor combination, not caring about the nutrition, if there is any, not caring about what the actual food will do to your body, but just taking that flavor profile and saying, this 3.5 million year old brain is going to love the bliss point in this food. And I find that it's the sort of thing that you can see, and I hope I can see this, in like 200 years' time, they'll look back on and say, whoa, that was scary stuff they're doing back then.
Yeah, and I've seen some things out of, if they've got the show Unwrapped or any of those other kind of food shows.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, looking behind the scenes and how it all functions and works, yeah?
Exactly, and you see these people, and they're food scientists, and what they do is, that literally is their job, is they're trying to find this particular combination of salts and glutamic acid and acid and spice and fat and everything, and put it into this particular package where your brain doesn't listen to your stomach, and which one, are we full, stop eating. It just, those signals are completely disrupted by levels of stimulus that you can't it could not have possibly dealt with, and you need to use sort of your higher mind to say, okay, let's not eat the entire bag of Doritos, right? And I think that it's a trick, I don't necessarily blame them. You get delicious, delicious chips and stuff. And I do consider them to be drugs. They're not nutritious. So if you're putting in your body, it's not nutrition, it's a drug. And that's fine. But, there's actually a meme I saw a while ago that said, a single Dorito has more nacho cheese goodness than kings would have for their entire life. And it's like, it's a joke, but that's actually true, right? That's like true. How much nacho cheese deliciousness did King Henry VIII or whatever have? Probably not that much.
Completely agree. Yeah, it's crazy, isn't it? So in that case, if we're seeing this from the food industry, and of course we know how pharma works too, but we'll leave that for another time. So now the food industry is working. Why is there then this kind of misunderstanding about why people get sick? Now, I don't know what your opinion on this is, but well, in fact, I'll ask you actually, do you think that people are metabolically ill because they're victims of that system, or is it their own responsibility for their own health? Because it seems to be, there's an argument to say, you know, you're responsible for what you eat, bad food's out there, don't eat it. Or you could sort of see the other side of the debate saying, well, actually, we're animals. And this thing, like you just said there, has been developed for us to become addicted to. And so we become victims of a system. Or is it somewhere in between?
I think that you can trace a lot of this back to the fact that we have post-World War II, these tremendous farming subsidies in the United States. And most of the grain that you're eating, even in England, is coming from the United States. Most of the sugar, if it, at least in the form of high fructose corn syrup, is coming from the United States. Because, you know, all the farmers and stuff collapsed post-World War II, and they created all these farm bills to basically make grain for no money at all, and needing to find places to put all this surplus grain after, for, you know, we stopped feeding a starving post-World War II planet. Well, what do you do with it all? You can't just pull the rug out from underneath all these farmers. So, okay, we've got all this corn. We got more corn than we can feed every cow on the earth. What do we do? Well, we turn it into sugar. Mm. Well, the sugar is now free. So what do we just put in everything? You know, why does bread need sugar? I saw a pack of sausages at the store. They were 50 gram sausages with 8 grams of sugar per sausage. Think about that.
Wow. 8 grams per sausage.
In a 50 gram sausage. I'm like, why does a sausage need that much damn sugar in it? Yeah, I don't think, yeah. Like, if you ask somebody to name 10 sweet things, nobody's going to see a sausage anywhere in that list, but they pack it in. And you can say, okay, I've got this literally free item that I can put in my food that makes people eat more of it so I can make more money. I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
You know, I've got this corn is phenomenally cheap. I can't feed it to cattle. People don't want to eat, you know, ears and ears of corn all the time. So let's grind it up, make it into tortilla chips so we can sell for 99 cents for a bag, you know, the size of your torso.
Yeah, yeah.
So we've got these surpluses of things, and I just think that that's we have this need for delicious things, and we have a desire to get, you know, more for our money, and we have these policies that I think no longer have any place, that nobody wants to be the bad guy and pull the plug on. Yeah. You know, there's what they call a ratchet effect. Whenever you put a law in place, it kind of only goes in one direction. You can do a little bit more. It never really comes back the other direction. And it's a tricky thing, because how do you fix that? You've got, you know, millions of people who are dependent on these industries now that are basically killing us. So people need to, the groundswell needs to come from, you know, from the bottom up, right? You need to have all these people who get educated on food and make the decision for themselves to say, you know what, I'm just not going to eat that anymore.
Yeah.
Okay, so you got all these chips on the shelf. That's fine. I walk by the chips every day. I don't buy them. And I would like to talk to people and say, you know what, I stopped buying those chips and it did me a lot of good, honestly. And honestly, I'm saving money than when I was stacking all the time, because I have like one, maybe two big meals a day. I buy everything in bulk and I cook it all myself in ways that I found are very quick to cook. And maybe you could give it a try.
I
don't think there's going to be anything you can do besides just get, you know, people to make these decisions and try it for themselves, experiment on themselves and see what happens. And, you know, we see things like, you know, Primal Foods and Chosen Foods or Primal Kitchen and these other companies that come out and they're making these, you know, high quality, expensive, admittedly, you know, goods, you know, sauces and marinades and dressings and everything else out of high quality ingredients. And they're doing very, very well for it. I mean, Primal Kitchen got sold to General Mills or something because they're just making money hand over fist.
Wow.
And the market is there. People want to get healthy. People look at themselves and they realize something is wrong. What can I change?
Yeah. But there's two factors there. So I actually run my own food business as well, keto food business, but it's food that cakes and things that I was making myself for my kids and for my family. And so, you know, I want to do that for other people. But I think the interesting thing is there that people's taste becomes dulled because the food they eat is so sweet. I mean, I know you know about food, but one of the sweetest things we could have eaten was probably a root vegetable in the past, you know, like going back a few hundred years. And now you can have the most sweet sugar whenever you like and put it on every single meal in forms of syrup. Yeah. Secondly, in terms of price, that's also a bit of a hard thing because, you know, you can move over to better ingredient products, but actually people have now become, okay, I know some people are hard up and they find hard times. I completely understand that. But equally, many people have seen in the marketplace that food is fairly cheap, although that's become the norm. And so changing is seen as expensive to them. And I think that's part of the problem. You know, you can educate people, but this change is so huge. And those two factors to say, maybe what you're going to be eating in the future is going to be a little bit less sweet, but that's okay. Going to get used to that. And secondly, you might have to put more money out there to get the proper food you need. And that's a tricky conversation to have with anyone, isn't it?
It is, but there's also this perception of what healthy food looks like, right? If you ask somebody, like, what's healthy? Well, they're going to say fruits and vegetables. Well, you know what? Per calorie, fruits and vegetables are phenomenally expensive, right? You'd need to eat bushels of them to get enough nutrition for a day, and that's going to cost, like, hundreds and hundreds of dollars.
True,
It's going to add up real quick. But if we talk about, you know, for example, the sort of diet that I would generally eat, I've done shopping lists for people for, you know, you say, I want 2000 calories or so a day, 150 grams of protein per day, $20. I can do that. You can go to the store, you can buy things like chicken leg quarters and eggs and, canned corned beef, tough cuts of meat, oxtail or brisket. And if you learn how to cook these things, cook like poor people used to cook, you can make some really, really good meals. And, when you cut out all the extra things that go into your body, they're not necessarily food, they're your chips and your candies and what else like that, you'd actually be surprised. But I think that the concept that food is expensive if it's healthy is from this sort of plant-based perception of what a healthy diet looks like. I mean, a healthy diet can look an awful lot like just bacon and eggs and chicken, which are fairly inexpensive. I mean, it can look like a big plate of vegetables. I don't think that's necessarily unhealthy for some people, but if that's what you're trying to eat, yes, that's going to be very expensive. So also shifting that mindset a little bit, I think could help.
Yeah.
You know, there was one of the low carb doctors, I forget his name, might've been, Ted Damon's got a patient who's literally homeless, and cooks, more or less by choice, but I mean, just is like a vagabond kind of guy, and cooks on a gas stove in the woods, bacon, eggs, and ground beef.
Wow. Yeah. So it's affordable to that person. Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. It's what he can do. And there's always something I think that you could probably cut out in your life to make room for your own health, because you're going to pay for it eventually later.
That's the thing, isn't it? It's the long-term cost is way more expensive, but people don't necessarily feel that when they're hungry now.
Yeah.
I think also the key thing as well, and I find this all the time with people, and I think people just have to experience it for themselves. I realize now that you can't tell people this, they have to feel it, but hunger is very conditional to what you're eating. So, you know, people are like, I can't fast or I can't eat. I couldn't skip a breakfast, for instance. I'd be starving hungry. I've got to keep snacking. And when you're like, yeah, but if you experienced it, you'd realize you're not hungry. And I've not eaten. It's now like, what, 3:30 in the afternoon where I am. I've not eaten since yesterday evening. I feel no hunger whatsoever because, you know, I'm just fat adapted now and I'm used to that. And so you do save your money that way too, because you're eating far less frequently than you would be grazing all day long on those Doritos, whatever it is you're eating.
Exactly. And that whole idea of that you can just not eat for a while is so toxic to people. Like they literally think that, okay, if I don't eat every, you know, couple of hours, I'm starving myself, or it's anorexia or something like that.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, that's if you refuse to eat when you're hungry. That's a very, very different thing.
Yeah.
And also to remove this perception of, you know, you're supposed to eat and you're supposed to feel hunger, you know, all the time. I just as an experiment one time, I was in business. I did some international travel. I was in Switzerland. And I decided on the trip home, the day before my trip, my plane flight, I just wouldn't eat. You know, going a 24-hour fast for me is no big deal. I just do 24 hours, and I'd get on the plane, and I'd come home, and I'd arrive at home because of the time swap pretty late at night, and I'd go to bed. And all in all, it ended up being a 72-hour fast.
It's actually really good for jet lag, I've heard. It's the circadian rhythm where people change their eating, right? So they get jet lag, and they change their eating habits, which makes jet lag way worse, doesn't it? So, yeah.
Just to see if I could do it. You know, if I got hungry, I could always grab something in the airport. But after I go past about the, you know, say 18 hour mark, it's just like, it's like I could eat, but you know, they'd come around. Do you want any pretzels? No. Do you want any peanuts? No, I'm good. And actually on that trip, the waitress or the stewardess came around and asked me if I was okay because I kept refusing food. Like if I was air sick or something, like, no, I'm fine. Thank you. You're very sweet, but no, thank you.
The anomaly is not eating. Isn't that weird?
Yeah. But you know, I went 72 hours. I was fine. I woke up the next day and just had a regular, meal at about noon, at the close of the 72 hours. And it was, I don't do long fasts like that very often. I just kind of wanted to see if I could, because I've done like 24 hours and stuff, a number of times in the past. And when you tell somebody, hey, you can go 3 days without eating and you're fine, just get some water and salt, they look at you like you're insane. Right? You go 3 days without eating? And that was like the old joke. I remember, this homeless person comes up to this woman in Beverly Hills and says, oh, I haven't eaten 3 days. And she goes, I wish I had your willpower.
Yeah.
But, willpower sucks. I have none. That's why I do. That's why I was born. That's why I got fat in the first place. That's why I do what I do, because it just, I can't just white knuckle my way through these things. I have to make it just comfortable, and it needs to be as low effort and comfortable as possible. And this is the best way I have found to, be in shape, feel healthy with very little effort. I mean, with almost no effort at all. I don't track anything. I don't spend a whole lot of time cooking. I don't have to spend a whole lot of time planning. If I do spend a lot of time cooking, it's for like some elaborate celebration meal, because I enjoy doing it, not because it's a chore. I work out every so often. I'm not like, people assume that I work out obsessively, and I don't.
That's exactly how it should be. But what I find interesting? You are, if you don't mind me saying, a liberated person by the sounds of it. You've made the environment, your food choices have now become your habits. Your habits are comfortable ones. Mm-hmm. Which you're then living a healthy lifestyle. That's exactly the way that I think everyone should be entitled to have as well. Yeah. But it's interesting, isn't it? Because I don't know. I find the philosophy behind our nations interesting, because I don't know if it's the Protestant ethos or something, but we definitely have a good versus evil mentality. And we are all too easy, in I say us, I mean people in our countries, to say, a guy has got a weight issue, a girl's got a weight issue, there's a moral thing there of gluttony and greed, and it's a moral dimension. And I find it fascinating how actually, because I know you said about, like, for instance, India and its diabetes versus obesity rate, there's an assumption in the Western world that you put weight on, then the diabetes follows, and it's all punishment for your weight gain, because you're greedy and you're feckless. And actually, why can't the world realize, and I hope it is coming around to this, that actually metabolic syndrome is the very heart of all of these different symptoms that come off it. And then when you start saying, well, why do we have metabolic syndrome? It's because actually we are animals who are being manipulated by the food industry, who have got really bad non-food around us all the time, and really appalling habits, which have grown up probably from the food industry and the last 150 years. So yeah, it's that moral dimension I find incredible. And go on.
What I was going to say is that I think we need to start treating obesity in the same way that we treat other substance abuse problems. I think that a lot of, one thing I really like about the UK and a lot of Europe is that they're very progressive in terms of their drug control policies. Portugal, you can basically have any drug you want and you're not going to be punished for it. And most people with substance abuse problems.
And their levels gone down, right? Haven't they?
Exactly. I think that that's a great argument for legalization of essentially everything that you can put in your body. But when you look at somebody who's obese, they don't, it's not like you look at them, hey, you're 400 pounds, you need to eat less. You think that that's news to them? They can't, they're addicts. Yeah. And if you got maybe 20, 30 pounds to lose, it's like, okay, maybe you just cut back a little bit, you're fine. But if you're, so obese that you're having trouble, getting in and out of your car, you recognize there's a problem and you know what you need to do to fix it and you can't. And that's an addiction problem. People could argue back and forth does food addiction exist? And it's like, have you ever talked to an obese person in your life? They sit down. I remember reading a story about this guy. He sat down and he ate a pizza, a whole pizza, and he made a second pizza, and he ate the second pizza, and he made a third pizza, ate the third pizza. And people were like, why didn't you just stop after the first pizza? And he said, I couldn't. I had 10,000 calories.
Yeah.
Every cell in his body was telling me he was starving. Or at least,
were starving. That's why. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's probably a big part of it too. But we need to start saying, okay, these people, they're not gluttons. Why do people get addicted to food? And maybe also as importantly, why don't some people get addicted to food? Why are some people just fine? I mean, like, I can have a couple of drinks and I'm fine, but I know people who can't and have either chosen not to, or their lives are completely ruined because they just simply cannot give up alcohol. It happens. Why? What's going on is different in my brain than what's going on in their brains or their bodies. Well, they've identified a lot of things about, the response to alcohol that alcoholics have that non-alcoholics don't have. They have drugs that can treat it. And they're working on some drugs, I think, that are treating obesity and treating appetite and food addiction, at least on some level. But I don't think that it's widely acknowledged enough that this is an addiction problem. And
but the question I have for you is that purposely done like that, do you think? I mean, the cynic in me thinks, well, the smoking gun, if it does come from big food, for instance, well, there might be vested interest to say, let's ignore that and say it's your fault as the individual. Mm-hmm. Or is it because of mindset that people just think that way and they don't really see it as an addiction problem? You know, is there a cynical dimension or an ignorance one?
There's this, I mean, let's see, cultural background of, you know, the sin of gluttony, right? Mm-hmm. And the, you know, the big fat king with the big feast and just shoveling food into his face because he can, because of the decadence of it all.
Yeah, and the power.
The decadence and the power. And I do because I can, because it feels good.
Yeah.
And I
and
just,
you can't, and I can. So we're different. You know, there's that as well, isn't there? Of course.
Exactly. You know, it's like this opulence of, you know, living in a giant mansion, having cakes and roast goose or whatever the hell kings ate. And that's how it was. And, you know, you as the common person emulating that level of power is disgusting.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
you must stop. And I think that mindset still persists. You still have a lot of people who do a lot of the fat shaming and stuff. And I don't really necessarily like that. I'd like to see people, I don't like people saying glorifying obesity and health problems, where you have kind of the ultimate blowback of that saying, I'm 400 pounds and I'm happy and I'm healthy. And no, you're not. But on the other side, you do have the people saying, oh, you're disgusting. I don't think that's helpful or appropriate either. You know, these people, I think that 99% of the time, if somebody is very large and has a lot of weight to lose, they're aware of it and they want to change. They just don't know how. And we need to help them. And I think that the best way to do that is kind of like, is to share stories, you know, and say, I was like you once, mm-hmm. you know, or at least myself, you know, I was 250 pounds. If I'd not discovered what I did, and I, you know, didn't manage to wrap my car around a tree, maybe I would be 300, 400 pounds by now. Mm-hmm. Because if I got sad, I ate a bunch of food. If I was happy, I celebrated with a bunch of food. That was kind of just how I dealt with all different kinds of feelings. And that was my drug of choice.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I want to help these people. I really do want people to feel the way I feel.
Yeah, you know? I totally agree with you on that. And you know what? I think that so much of it is understanding how we work. And I think also understanding the food we have. So I think it's really quite tragic that a lot of people, when they're trying to lose weight or trying to get healthy, will say fruit is the first thing they go for, which in my opinion is mostly confectionery anyway. You know,
you think apples this big ever happen?
Yeah.
Do you think squirrels and birds would have ever allowed those to exist? No.
Well, the squirrels and birds would be obese and died of diabetes years ago, wouldn't they? That'd be in really big trouble.
Or they just already have like giant pterodactyl sized birds because they're all trying to compete over these giant energy rich fruits.
I think that's a good point, yeah.
Maybe that's what's going to happen to Earth in like another few hundred years or whatever. This is where we're all going to go. The humans are going to die out, and then these fruit trees are going to breed these gigantic pterodactyl birds that then end up ruining the world.
Rip each other to pieces and get the fruit.
After the nuclear wars and everything, the birds are going to take over.
You heard it here first, everyone.
Yeah, you heard it here.
Yeah, that's heard it here. But, you know, but the fruit has evolved to be eaten. So in evolution, fruit is there to be consumed, to be digested. However, that doesn't mean we've evolved to eat fruit. That's a very different thing, isn't it? And I find this idea that fruit's a healthy thing for you. Like, I grew up in a household where we didn't eat much fruit. And I had a girlfriend at university who came over to us to stay. And she was like, where's your fruit bowl? And I was like, oh, we never had it really. And she's like, why? And I said, well, my mum just doesn't buy it. And I asked my mum, like, why don't we have fruit? We're the weirdos in the first street without the fruit. I didn't realize. She was like, it's really full of sugar. I'm not eating that rubbish. And I was like, but it's really healthy, mum. You've got to eat fruit, otherwise you'll die or something.
But it's natural sugar, right?
Yeah, natural sugar.
Natural sugar.
Like natural tobacco, you know?
Yeah.
And I just thought to myself, like, you know, when I've learned more and I realized that actually, you know, fruit is, well, I mean, the apple, do you know the evolution of the apple? And like,
there was a single tree in Kazakhstan that is the mother of all modern apples. And that eventually spread throughout all of Europe and got brought over to the New World. And a lot of people think that, you know, Johnny Appleseed, do you guys know about Johnny Appleseed? Is that strictly an American thing?
No, what's that then? Tell me.
Okay, Johnny Appleseed is a folk character who actually existed. He was a real guy who went all over the United States as sort of this traveler and whatever, and he planted apple seeds.
Wow.
And you know, through a lot of the fruit orchards and whatever can trace their along the East Coast can trace their origins back to him. Funny thing was, he wasn't planting Red Delicious apples or Macintosh apples. He was planting crab apples to make alcohol. That's the part they leave out of the story to tell the kids.
That's the moral bit that they don't like.
They didn't really like that bit.
I don't like that.
apples are interesting too, because I look at I look at my childhood, right? There was three apples, right? There was the red one, the yellow one, and the green one. And only like one of them was any good, right? The green ones were the good ones, yellow ones were kind of okay, and the red ones were mushy and gross.
Yeah, totally agree.
And now I can go to the store, and there's like 100 different apples, and every time I go back, I see a different apple that I've never heard of before. And there's people that like have these artisanal apples and these, what you call like legacy apples or, what's the word I'm looking for?
I don't do apples, to be fair. I'm not the expert on apples.
Ribeye,
sirloin, I could do steak, no problem.
Yeah. They're this big, and they're pink, and they're shiny, and they're amazing. And they're 600 calories of sugar, very little fiber. You bite right through them, they're juicy and amazing. And it's like, that's not an apple anymore. This is something that is highly, highly altered from its natural state because we want it to be perfect for a human to consume. Whereas the apple as it existed in nature is probably not, didn't evolve alongside a human being as it's the progenitor of its seeds, probably something more like a bird, or a squirrel or a chipmunk or whatever the heck they got in Kazakhstan that would eat these things and then poop the seeds out and whatever. And we don't even eat the seeds, we don't eat the whole apple.
Well, that's the other thing as well, of course, so from my understanding, the evolution of apples as well, before they became, cultivated by humans, it was actually bears gorging on them to try and fatten up to hibernate for the winter in September.
Oh, yeah, bears,
And then they would, poop the seeds out, they'd grow and they'd sort of spread across the rest of Europe from Kazakhstan and Russia and that area. And you sort of think, so the food that we know that nature has, by complete evolution and chance, meant it as a hibernation fattening up food, we now promote that as a even higher sugar fructose bomb health food. That's bizarre. That's just weird. Yeah.
Now, here's the thing is I will be controversial in the low carb space saying I don't think apples made you fat. Okay, that's one of the things I will generally say is that people who eat a lot of fruit, I mean, the correlation, causation, whatever, but people who eat a lot of fruit, don't tend to be very fat. But what I have found is that fruit makes me hungry. And I have said that I believe hunger is what makes you fat.
Love that.
And you can eat, an apple and it's like, okay, the apple's not going to make you fat, but
it's a trigger, isn't it?
Exactly. So I'm going to eat an apple. Then an hour later, I'm going to have, a box of Oreos, or I'm going to have an apple, but I'm also going to have a half a jar of peanut butter with it. And because an apple is not going to be satisfying for a long period of time. And that I think is the key is don't eat foods that make you hungry. There's even low carb, compliant foods that I've just found make me hungry. And so I've started to cut back on those or eliminate those for at least short periods of time. If I want to say drop some, the holiday weight, or if I take a little break and blow it up a little bit, I'll say, okay, I got to cut back to the basics and I'll cut out even the low carb carnivore or whatever friendly foods. And I say, I'll just cut those up for a while, and I find that my desire to eat drops to a very low level, and I don't get that sort of the trigger to eat everything that isn't nailed down. That's also part of self-experimentation is like try these things and see what they actually do for you. Because I've also heard the other side, people who are like strict carnivore and they'll introduce some fruit and find out that actually they like it, or it does work well for them, or maybe it helps with digestion, or maybe it gives them extra energy for a workout or that kind of thing. It's like, okay, yeah, great. Great. It worked for you. It didn't work for me, but that's cool. Do what you got to do.
You're incredibly mature, Dan. I mean, the keto
you are so wrong. You have no idea how much I'm dialing back on this particular show. Just because, I know I'm going to go across the pond. You sound like, a professor. You sound like you're narrating a nature documentary or something. So I got to put on my good guy hat.
Covers up a lot of ignorance, believe me, it does. I'm the accent saving my ass right now, but not that I saw on the show. But I just want to say though, the keto police love to bring people down. There's nothing more annoying than going onto a Facebook group where someone says, is this keto? I'm not annoyed by them, by the way. I think that's a completely reasonable question. And then somebody will write something really quite degrading or rude back to them. And you think, come on, let's help each other here, please people. Yeah. And if someone, I just think what you said there is so true, and that's why it is mature. If somebody says something and it's about their own experience, their own life, what works for them, then that's fine. Like, great for them. You know, it doesn't affect me, it affects them. Yeah. So if it works for them. Yeah. But I don't understand this sometimes tribalism, and I'm going to come on to veganism in a minute. This tribalism of like, you're right, or I'm right and you're wrong. And you know, what are you thinking? You're not in ketosis. And I think it's bizarre how we've gone with, some people are like that, aren't they? And they, especially maybe social media, express themselves in that way.
There are so many people who have made a diet a substitute for personality, and it drives me nuts. It's like, oh my God.
Or religion. Or religion.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I remember, like, especially when carnivore was having its, like, big day, you know, Sean Baker, whatever, he goes on Joe Rogan, and, you know, everyone's like, oh, this guy only eats meat, and he's shredded, and he's getting on the Concept 2 rowing machine, almost folding the damn thing in half. Okay, this is pretty cool. And then, so carnivore blew up, and it became a big thing. That's, like, a lot of time when I tried, like, the strict carnivore, and that worked pretty good for me. But, you know, people are like, oh, you got pepper on your steak. That's a plant. You're not a carnivore. Shut the hell up. I mean,
you drink a coffee. What? How could you call yourself a carnivore?
Yeah, okay, you know? It's coffee. Oh, you know. And I remember somebody like, Paul Saladino or something was, I'm calling you out, Paul, was saying he would go to KetoCon and he threatened to slap somebody's coffee out of their hand. I'm like, Paul, you slap coffee out of my hand. I'm slapping your face off your head.
Which is carnivore, but it's getting slapped still.
Yeah, exactly. But it drives me nuts. Like, people, I've tried giving up coffee and bringing it back. Coffee works well for what it does for me. You know, life does not seem to be as good as if I have coffee in it. No big deal. You know, I've given up all plants, and that to me just becomes a little bit more boring. I like a little bit more variety. There are certain plants that I tolerate very well. Your cruciferous vegetables, asparagus, whatever. I like them. I enjoy them. I cook them usually very well. I usually like, you know, for digestion reasons, I try to cook them, you know, a little bit beyond al dente. But I enjoy them. I eat them, you know, but I still don't consider them necessarily part of the food. But yeah, this tribalism is something that's just, it drives me nuts. It's like, just stop. You can't say that what you're doing is even the best possible thing for yourself. All you can say is that it worked pretty good up to this point. Who knows? Yeah. You might have some kind of hormonal shift happen. There's a lot of people that say, yeah, oh, you know, I did keto or whatever, and I was at 30 and it worked great. And now I'm, you know, 45 and I tried it and it's doing, you know, it's not working as good in the way that I was doing it before. You know, either they were doing very high protein or very high fat or whatever, and they have to shift something. And so, I mean, have a little bit of humility. You can't prescribe a universal diet for everybody and assume that you're going to have excellent results with every human being who tries it. We're you know, we're pretty diverse. It's probably a base diet that's pretty healthy for most people, but if you're talking about optimizing, that's pretty personal.
Yeah, completely agree. And this is why I find the veganism argument interesting, because, and I know you have spoken to many vegans, and I will say this for you, unlike a lot of people, you actually engage in conversation. A lot of people would maybe just write somebody off. I mean, maybe you can say you've done that too. I don't know. But I find that, okay, so something a bit awkward happened for me once. I was, I knew somebody who was a vegan, and I just had a conversation with her, and I genuinely wanted to learn, because I do want to learn. And I said, can you just tell me, like, is veganism good for you? I don't think it is, but I don't know it's not. So I wanted to find out what she thought, why she thought it was good. So she went on the vegan group that I'm a member of and was posting my comments on that vegan group on Facebook. And then people were piling in with lots of information. She was then sending it to me so I could see the comments that she was writing about me. And then I could see the articles that were shared with her. And I started reading them, and there was not. And I'm not trying to make it, I'm a scientist. I'm definitely not. I'm not, you know, qualified in this area. But from what I was reading, it was very loose correlation stuff. It wasn't very clear, like, examples of how veganism was healthy. So I'd question stuff, and then she'd go back to her group, and then instead of them coming back with the answers I was looking for, they came back with the insults. And, well, it sounds like he's ignorant and he's stupid. And then it became a case of, well, he doesn't care for the planet, which is one, or he hates animals and he wants them to suffer. And I was like, hang on, I'm reading this about myself in this group here, and I do care about the planet a lot. And I also really care about animals' welfare, and also care about my health and the health of human beings. And I thought, we're talking about a different thing here. They're talking, their reason for eating a diet is not necessarily health-based, although they might have told themselves it is. And yet they're making out somehow that I'm just a tyrant who's trying to come out with a way to make animals suffer and destroy the planet and, I don't know, burn a forest or something. And I thought, it's interesting how we're not talking in the same language or the same premises.
Every time I've spoken to vegans about, especially initially about the health consequences of one's diet, the goalposts might as well just be kept on the back of a wheelbarrow or something, because they're moving quick. The conversation shifts very quickly from the health argument. You know, there's some decent studies, I guess, with a population wide, vegan studies, and you can say, okay, the Seventh Day Adventists in Southern California, they do seem to live a very long time. Mm-hmm. But we actually talk about why that is. We don't really know that. You know, we can look at these mouse models. I mean, I was talking to a guy who was a medical student. Well, this was a while ago now, where he's like, here's heme iron, causing colon cancer. And it was a rat study with rats that they had genetically modified to be susceptible to colon cancer. And it's like, okay, you take a rat, you give it colon cancer, and you give it heme iron, and the colon cancer gets worse. Okay, what conclusion could you possibly draw from that?
What link to me does that have then?
Yeah. Okay, so if I'm a rat who's genetically modified, maybe I don't eat heme iron.
Be careful.
I wake up tomorrow and I find myself to be a genetically modified rat, I'll be very careful.
That's the least of your worries, to be fair. You've got to explain it to your wife first, but okay.
Exactly. So we would, then eventually the argument does shift. It's like, animal welfare and saving the planet and things like that. And, you know, this is something that I kind of wrestled with as well, because I've got a rather radical, nonviolent sort of position on a lot of things. And the question come up to me is, why would I limit that in my species, right? Why is it okay for me to kill and eat a cow and not say, okay, it's fine to kill and eat somebody from, China? Why is that different? They look different than me. They're different. You know, they speak differently than me. Why can't I just kill and eat them too? And that was a difficult question, actually.
They are very different, surely. I mean, I don't know. I just think if somebody says that, then their empathy towards humanity is pretty limited. And I care for animals,
but they're not the same
as humans, are they? Let's be honest.
They would argue they are. All right. And it's like, okay, how can I argue that they're not? And the tricky bit, and there's actually a really good book called The Vegetarian Myth. By Lier Keith, who I recommend to everybody. This is something I kind of struggle with about the ethics of meat consumption. And it really kind of boils down to if you can't look at human animal relationships as sort of a hierarchical top down sort of relationship. It really is a cycle, right? Most of the time, an animal that is in the care of a farmer or rancher is actually going to be taken fairly well care of. You know, they're going to be, if they get sick, they're going to be getting medicine. If they break their leg, they're going to be fixed up.
No predators. I mean, let's be honest. Most of these animals would have a predator that should wipe out them when they're born, pretty much. And yet, they don't have that, do they?
Exactly. And you know, the death in nature is not like a nice death. They think that like old cows die, you know, with their family at their bedside holding their hooves. That's not what happens. You get eaten, your guts get ripped out, or you break your leg in a hole and then starve to death as rain pours on you. That's what nature does.
Yeah.
And ultimately, we need to look at the fact that we did evolve as apex predators. We evolved to require the things that are in meat. Maybe we didn't evolve to eat meat because we came from largely plant-eating, apes swinging in trees. But, you know, when we figured out how to hit something bigger than us with a rock or a sharp stick and get all the nutrients out of them, that's what catapulted us to the top of the food chain. And we do need the things that come in meat. And maybe there's some technology that's out there as far as like supplementation that says maybe we can survive on less meat than we need before. But I don't think that means we need to abandon it entirely. I think when we have something that maybe is being done poorly, it doesn't mean you stop doing it. It means you find better ways to do it. And you have, these farms that are very ethical. I mean, I live in Northern California. I live in Silicon Valley, and I live, my work is right near Tesla, like the actual Tesla factory.
Oh, wow.
If you go one exit down the freeway from Tesla, in Fremont, California, you'll see this big green stretch of grass, just kind of between the freeways. And there's like an Applebee's and like a TJ Maxx shopping center and like a McDonald's and stuff. And right in the middle is a big green patch, and there's cows grazing on it.
Okay.
Right. So they find ways to use land that's otherwise unusable. This land is probably like, you can't build there, otherwise it would be building something there, right? But So we've got something you can't build anything on. We'll put cows there. They'll prevent the water from running off, by eating the grass. They're going to, keep the grass growing, and they're going to keep the water from running off into all the shopping centers and stuff around there. And then when the cows are, done being free in this many acres of green land that they're free in, and they're never going to get any kind of predation, they're monitored by people on a regular basis, then they're going to go off to feed people.
Yeah, and also they will put droppings into the ground, which will then put the nitrogen back into the soil, make more healthy soil with bacteria. It's a cycle, isn't it, of life?
It is.
Quite a physical badly there.
Yeah, and you talk about, you know, the emissions and all this other kind of stuff about, you know, cow farts or whatever, and it's mostly burps, but cow fart sounds funnier when vegans say it. you know, where did that carbon come from in that methane? That carbon came from the air, which went into the grass, which they ate, and then came back out again. But say carbon's coming out of your tailpipe, came out of, you know, oil wells and stuff, so that's introducing new carbon into the air as opposed to just recycling carbon that's been happening on this planet, which is basically how this planet works and has for the last, you know, at 14 billion years. Yeah. That's just what happens. And, you know, you've got also the other people who are coming up with these regenerative farming methods that sequester more carbon into the ground than they're putting out. You know, these Joel Salatins and Alan Savory type peoples and Nicolette Neyman, who have these regenerative farms that are, they're net carbon sinks. And they're not, what they're doing is not new. It's just they're bringing back things that used to do before. And they're able to do this at a profit. They're able to sell a premium product at the end of it. They're able to make businesses off of it. And I think that that's an amazing thing. And, you know, there's always going to be demand for this kind of thing. And if you could point to it and say, look, okay, you're concerned with the environment. I am saving the environment. Literally me, on my farm, I am saving the environment. What are you doing?
Yeah.
And you kind of go, oh, okay, this is actually kind of cool. And I would like to see more of that, honestly.
Yeah, and you've hit the nail on the head there, because it beggars belief to me that people think, okay, you can be a different type of vegan. I'm not saying this is atypical, but there are a lot of people like this who are eating avocados flown in from South America and Mexico and places to Europe. And that's somehow more sustainable than eating your ribeye that's been grown in the fields from a few blocks down the road from you in the field somewhere. But there's also, and this is what I think people don't understand, and I think this is why I'm always interested. I've always got this balance, I think, Dan, between, you know, what's genuine like ignorance and what's cynical kind of side of me thinking that it's misinformation. Because, you know, the vegan industry to survive, if you didn't have that animal population, is all about putting fossil fueled fertilizers into the ground to replace the nutrients that are being stripped out of it by only growing plants. So what you're saying is the cycle of the animal and the land, which then makes the grass, which feeds it, et cetera, which I think is the natural way it's been for millions of years, comes down to evolution again. But they seem to think that the fossil fuel method of replacing nutrients, and while the soil's dying gradually and the bacterial diversity is dying, is somehow the better option for the planet. Is that ignorance, or is it this kind of more, it's a cover up by somebody who's making money out of that?
I think that,
and by the way, I'm not saying you should know the answers. You're not the UN, but I'm just saying, I think the sort of person who's got opinions. That's what I'm asking.
You have a very strong ethical belief on the behalf of the vegans that says, okay, at the core of everything, eating animals is wrong. What can I find to support this? Yeah. And what information do I need to ignore entirely to continue this belief, right? There are several things. Everything about eating meat is bad for the planet. Everything about eating meat is bad for the humans. Everything about eating meat is unethical. Everything meat bad, period. And so you need to
blitz you on all those topics, so you can't say anything anymore, I guess.
Exactly. And you know, they call it a gish gallop, or they just blast you with a bunch of crap. And you know, these studies may be decent, they may be terrible, but it doesn't matter because you can't respond to all of them all at once.
Yeah.
And you know, people will believe an awful lot of nonsense so they don't have to change their mind. And this is what happens to, you know, whack nut conspiracy theorists. This is what happens to religious zealots. This is what happens to a lot of people that just latch onto one particular ideology as their sort of core personality trait. It's dangerous, right? I mean, there's the woman, that vegan YouTuber, who thought she was being demonetized and kept down in the searches. So she went to YouTube headquarters and shot it up. This is just like 2 years ago. Whoa. Luckily, nobody got hurt. I think she might have gotten gunned down by the police or something. But she literally went to the YouTube headquarters and shot it up because she thought that they were preventing her from getting her message about veganism out. And this is a dangerous, you know, you take these people who have maybe a strong sort of sense of ethics and they want to save the world and they want to be the good person. And
you have,
So you have these ideologies they latch onto, and then you have at the same time these food companies who have now seen this new market, right? Of you know, they used to have like, okay, low fat's a big thing. Oh, low fat! Now we're going to come out with all these low fat products and get all these people who want to do low fat. Okay, low fat's dead. Okay. Mm-hmm. Plant based, vegan, saving the world, saving the universe, saving being ethical, being more healthy. Meatless Mondays, whatever. We're going to get that market. So we're going to take all these vegans and we're going to promote them. And we're going to, you know, take these James Cameron types who, you know, owns a vegan protein company, and we're going to have him make these nonsense movies like The Game Changers and whatever. And we're going to promote them on Netflix, the biggest, you know, video streaming service in the world. And then we're going to make more money from that. So I think that you start off with an ideology, and you get some big names and some big money behind it. And the companies see this market, and they will bolster it so that they can make their own money. And it's a cycle that feeds into itself. At least that's kind of how I see it from somebody outside of that.
Yeah, well, I love that. I think you've hit the nail on the head. I think you're starting from a point. I'm going to talk about politics and political philosophy in a second, if I may. But I think you and I both start from a point that most people start from a place of goodwill. You know, that most people have honest intentions, probably, and they want the best. But actually, how they see themselves can be the distortion that causes the problem. But equally, there are people that can then monetize that and abuse it. So I think you're right with the cycle there. So can I ask you about your anarchist ideas and beliefs? Because one of the things we had a conversation on Twitter about was the fact that I want to know more about anarchy, and I don't. Sure. I'm not an anarchist myself. I think I describe myself as a. Well, I love an that. Yeah, yeah. It depends how convincing you are. I guess I'm a democratic socialist who's more okay. That term itself could be debated a little bit. I guess that's more like a social democrat in most of our countries compared to what socialism has come from. But certainly democracy is part of that. And I guess my view of the state is that I see it as a net good. It's very poor, and the way it works is quite appalling. And sometimes the powers the state has is damaging to the individual. Of course, I believe that. But I still see it as a net good in the way that it's a system and a vehicle to bring about change. But is it right to say that you think it's a net negative in the way that it can actually cause this problem and perpetuates it for the individual? I don't want to take the words from your mouth. What do you think?
Sure. That is largely like kind of my position. We're talking about it on a mechanical level, right? I do think that state is a net drag on the economy. And I'll give you an example.
Okay.
In the United States in 2019, this is the last numbers I remember off the top of my head, there was $2.6 trillion spent on anti-poverty programs, federal, state, and local, in the United States. $2.6 trillion. Okay, this is education, welfare, medical, all that kind of stuff. One-fifth of the United States lives under the poverty line. It's about 60 million people, right? Mm-hmm. What's 2.6 over 60 million people?
You're actually asking, what? Sorry.
It's like $50,000. So it's $50,000 for every man, woman, and child living below the poverty line.
Wow.
Cut them a check. Amazing. That's $200,000 for a family of four. If you just took that, if you just didn't take that money, or just cut them a check, cut out all the red tape, you take money from one group, cut everybody else a check, 60 million people all get $50,000 in the mail every year. There's no more poverty, period, done. Everything else is just getting lost. And this isn't the whole, this is only programs to help the poor. You know, we're not talking about defense. We're not talking about Social Security. No, strictly speaking, to help the poor. And so I view that as a drag. And I see that this $2.6 trillion that could be used to start businesses and get people employed and develop skills. You know, I look at the bad things that the state has done. Let's look at, for example, Walmart. Okay, what's the worst thing Walmart has done? They don't pay their people very much. They fire you for, you know, very little reasons. What's the worst thing the United States has done? We got nuclear bombs on Nagasaki and Hiroshima. So they bombed civilians. So they infected a bunch of black people in the South with syphilis just to see what would happen. They conducted experiments on people with mind control drugs and MK Ultra, which has been declassified, is no longer like a nut job conspiracy theory anymore.
Yeah. I've had the worst food policy that's affected health around the whole world, killing millions and making money into servitude of ill health.
Yeah. So when I look at anarchy, is not the absence of rules, it is the absence of rulers. And when you have an absence of rulers, you have an absence of a class that is exempt from the consequences of their actions. I mean, you can look at every basic major world leader in the last, I don't know, 50 years, and say at some point during their term of rule, they committed a heinous war crime. None of them are in jail. None of them. You know, Obama, you know, bombed Somalia and Ethiopia without any kind of permission from Congress. You know, you've got George Bush and Jr. doing all kinds of stuff in the Middle East. You've got, I mean, Reagan, you're putting all his stuff and do all his deals with the Balkans and in Russia and, you know, all the different wars out in where the hell is he? Did I'm a major historian. I don't have it all at the top of my head right now. But you can point to all these crimes, I mean, objective crimes. You can see them enumerated on many websites. None of them are in jail because being an elected official means basically that you don't have to follow your own rules. And that, I think, is a very dangerous thing. One thing that I can say about history that I know that seems to pan out over and over and over again is that while I personally believe people are generally good, when people are exempt from the consequences of their actions, they tend to make choices that are bad for society overall.
Well, that's the Milgram effect you described there. You know, do you know the Milgram effect experiments in psychology?
Milford?
Milgram. Do you know about these? So basically, in a nutshell, this is post-Holocaust. And so basically, people were giving electric shocks to somebody.
The
shocks. And basically, because there was somebody in a white coat saying, did you know that this is all okay? It's in the name of science and you're not responsible. People went to the extent of murdering the other person. Of course, they didn't actually murder them, but they thought they had, which was the psychology of take away responsibility. And of course, people can do the most heinous, horrible crimes, even if they're normal people. I do agree with that. And that experiment clearly shows that.
Yeah, and you know, you've got a lot of these people talk about corporations and whatnot, but I mean that's actually a legal protection status granted by the government. When people act shitty, you know, at the top of corporation, I mean nobody punishes them directly. Maybe they fine the company writes a check for $50 million. But you know, I was just reading something about in the 1700s, 1800s, there was a wheat shortage in England, and so the bakers were baking the bread with whatever they could find to bolster the flour. You know, put like chalk and stuff in the bread.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, things with arsenic and stuff, and just whatever they dug out of the ground, people getting sick, people dying. And, I mean, do you know what happened when these bakers got found out? They didn't go, like, file a grievance and hopefully take it to an arbitration court and, you know, talk to their prime minister about it. They kicked the door in, and they bashed the baker's head into the ground.
Oof, wow.
They were not held, because they had to be held responsible for their actions, for poisoning people. Right.
Yeah.
And okay, that's a little bit of an extreme example. I understand that. But the fact of the matter is that we have a lot of systems that are in place right now, you know, especially when you're very, very wealthy, we are isolated from consequences. And that is dangerous, especially because we're also very wealthy and powerful. You can affect the lives of a lot of people in a very direct way while you remain behind, you know, your glass pane and don't have to worry about anything actually happening to you. And that leads to people doing things that maybe they don't even see themselves as a villain. Maybe they see themselves as a savior. And if something bad happens to somebody, well, that's just all in the name of progress or whatever the case may be. And that's scary to me.
That's interesting. So, because I was thinking this about you, I thought, well, because I've stood for Parliament 3 times now, so I didn't tell you that before because I didn't know what you're going to say about it. So you might see me as part of that system, but I'm not. I'm just a guy who thought I'll chance my hand and go for it. They didn't vote for me, by the way, so don't worry. They rejected me squarely. But I kind of see the state and the system as the apparatus to for any citizen, you, me, anybody, to have access to get elected into to make change. But it sounds like you're saying that the individual could be corrupted by that because the system itself is flawed, whatever government you have. Is that what you mean?
I do. And you know, are there good people working in government? I think there are. I live in Northern California. I think that in San Francisco and in Oakland and Berkeley, in Alameda, in this area, we have some very idealistic people who are trying to do some very, very good things. But let's say you are an elected official. You do something that you think is the best thing to do. It gets written into law. It ends up being the wrong thing.
Hmm.
It's already written into law. And that's tricky. I also think that when you have this, you know, this ability to affect the lives of a lot of people, it's going to tend to attract people who like power. And
it's definitely true. Yeah. That's worrying, isn't it?
Yeah. People talk about, you know, different politicians, you know, greasing the palms of all their friends and their buddies' companies, and they're writing like regulations and things to help particular industries over others because they have friends or family or are personally involved in these things. This is something that Trump got accused of a lot. And I'm not going to talk about anybody, about Trump much, but you know, we have people who definitely use the system to their own advantage, and they're attracted to this sort of thing. And it's like, okay, if you could have a government, a powerful government full of angels, yeah, sure, that's great. But you're not going to. And I think if you're going to have a mixed society of good and bad people, the bad people are going to want to be the people at the top.
Yeah.
And that makes, you know, that's a very tricky problem to solve. And, you know, limiting the abuses of government power has kind of been one of the core problems that Western political philosophy has been trying to solve forever.
And it never has solved, has it? Let's be fair. You think, I mean, your country is very interesting to me because in some ways, as a brand new modern political concept, they really tried checks and balances and scrutiny and everything. And actually, you know, you still get Nixon, you still get Trump, you still get these, you know, leaders. You go, wow, that's not what the founding fathers planned in the first place. No, they did.
Here's the tricky bit, right? And this is we're gonna veer off course here a little bit.
I know, but I love this. I knew I'd love this conversation. I hope you do too. I'm learning a lot here.
There's a kind of a fringe libertarian ideology that I don't necessarily prescribe to, but I think it makes some good points, called Hoppianism.
The guy about brutal, savage, and short life. Is that what you mean?
I'm talking about Hans Hermann Hoppe.
Oh, sorry, I'm completely going on the wrong track. Sorry, Hobbes I was thinking of course. Yeah, yeah. Yep. Thomas Hobbes.
Okay. Hoppe is, in my opinion, a jackass. He gets a lot of stuff wrong. He's a bit of a xenophobe. But I'm going to be very clear. I am not talking about Hoppe as a person. I'm talking about this particular idea. And one of his ideas was that democracy in and of itself is a bad idea, because if you vote for your own tyranny, you are less likely to be opposed to it, right? If you vote in some guy who you say, well, he's my guy, and he's bombing all those people. I don't really necessarily think he's bombing, but he's doing this one thing that I think is great, and he's my guy. I'm not going to, take torches to the street. And I didn't do anything to elect this king. Well, you know, the guillotine comes out, right? But if it's my elected official and I say, oh, well, it was a fair election and whatever, and it's my guy, well, we'll just wait till the next cycle and hopefully the next guy will be better or whatever. And it's like, I don't know. I look at the system as it exists now, and I look at the evils that are being conducted by officials, and, you know, people that are dying, people that are having their lives made far more difficult or, destroyed because of policies. And I look at, like, well, the system we got either allowed this to happen or explicitly, you know, brought it about on purpose. So maybe it's not so great. is it that we're implementing it imperfectly? Well, maybe. I mean, we're all imperfect people, right? So if the idea was that the system only works if everybody's perfect, it's not a very good system, right? So I guess that's kind of where I sit on that one.
Okay, so the actual, and I appreciate time is tight now, but so it's almost like the system that you think we have is the corrupting force that does not work with humanity where we are and our evolution. But in that case, can I just ask, and let's bring this back to low carbon keto and food generally then, and nutrition. So what would you think would be a better solution, and how would a different political system bring about a healthier society, a healthier population?
Okay, so if we just totally, scorched earth, burned it all down and started from scratch, I think we would need to have a completely market-based solution to both healthcare and to food. Okay, and some people might say it's pretty radical, but if you look at back before we had government control of healthcare, about a week's wages was enough all people needed to afford healthcare for a year. And food cost what it cost. People would generally pay a little bit more for food, as part of their budget. Now they didn't have to buy cell phones or whatever, but if we actually saw what it costs to grow corn and what it costs to grow sugar and what it costs to make beef, and if I was able to have a very clear understanding of what things actually cost and was had the right competition between different suppliers of healthcare and of food and so forth over, without barriers to that business, I think we'd come up with clever solutions that me as just some guy would not be able to come up with. I mean, we've got silly laws here, like you can't sell health insurance over state lines. Why not? It's all the same country. Okay. But I can't sell insurance from Nevada to California. So everybody that's already in the state doing business basically has, what's the word, plurocracy? Plurocracy?
Yeah.
Not monopoly, but there's like a small number of people that have the business. And yeah. I mean, there's
oligarchy,
a lot of
people.
Yeah, something like that. So you've got you got 350 million people, at least in the United States. You got 7 billion people in the world. And I think that if you let all 7 billion minds work towards the problem that each individual mind thinks is the most important problem to solve right now, you've come up with some really clever stuff. I mean, you weren't concerned about what was going to be your next cell phone to buy in 1990, right? Because nobody's even come up with it yet. But the whole industry, sprang up to solve these problems. And I think the best way to foster that is to get out of the way. And let people solve their own problems in their own, in their own families and their own communities, because people are smart. And if you give them the ability to do that, I think more often than not, it works out pretty good.
Yeah, fascinating. I think that's really interesting. And I think things like cryptocurrencies definitely tie into that worldview because it is freed from fiat currency. And, you know, it's going to be very interesting to see what happens. And I've been following you on that topic as well. Yeah. I appreciate, by the way, that I know that it's really mean doing this podcast on the Friday because I'm coming to the end of my day. So I'm about to go home and relax. You're about to start work. So I really am very aware of your time and that you're going to have to go into work fresh and ready for action. And it's been almost an hour and a half, which is incredible. I was going to finish up, if I may, just by you did recommend one book, but what books could you recommend to me and others to read to educate ourselves?
Well, I mean, probably the first book I read on the low carb way of doing things was just Keto Clarity by Jamie Moore. It's a nice, simple book written for laymen, well sourced. It's a good book. It's, you know, it's pretty old now. A lot of new science has come out. I'm not sure if he's got a newer edition out than the one I've read, but I think this is a good place to start. I like some of the keto cookbooks, the Maria Emmerich cookbooks. A lot of people can become very bored with their food, and Maria Emmerich does some great cookbooks to help people come up with good ideas for delicious food. And unlike a lot of the other, you know, keto cookbooks I have come across, her recipes actually work and aren't terrible. A lot of stuff, you know, like, oh, you make this, you know, keto, you know, loaf of brownie or whatever. And it's just, it's terrible. It doesn't work at all. But her stuff always works. I guess if I want to get into philosophy, there's anything by Murray Rothbard. I don't recommend reading Hans Hermann Hoppe. I think he's, like I said, I think he's a jackass, but he's just because he makes some good points. I recommend Free to Choose by Milton Friedman and some good stuff about how markets help solve problems.
I've read that book, actually, yeah.
It's a good one. It's a good one.
I don't agree with Milton Friedman, but this is a debate for another time. But there's so much we can talk about. Right.
He was also wrong about a lot of things, in my opinion.
Like all of us, right? I mean, that's the thing as well. Like, it's good to say, like, you made the point earlier on, you know, like, here's my guy or what. You should actually say yes in this regard, but that way he didn't understand because of this reason or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, like Hayek or whatever. You can all go back to their period in history and say, well, they're seeing it from their point of view. And actually, we realized from this event that that didn't work like that. So, yeah, good point. And in terms of Twitter, sorry, you're at Steak and Iron, right? So they can also engage with you on there.
I love the chat. You know, we have fun out there. That's pretty much the only place to find me. I have an Instagram account. I've literally never posted anything on it. there's sometimes some, I know this is a family show, but there's sometimes some language on my Twitter account. So be aware, it's at least a PG-13.
I sound like I'm like a Disney production now, don't I? Okay. So, thank you so much, Dan, for your time today. I've really enjoyed that. I hope you have too. And I think we've covered so many different topics I just thought would be good to get into. And there's plenty more to talk about. So please come back one day if you're interested in that. That'd be great for me.
I would love to. I would absolutely love to.
And have a great day at work today and enjoy your weekend when it comes, okay?
You as well. Thank you, Dan.
Cheers. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Hello, you still there? Dan here. I can see you're one of the keen ones because you're still listening. So, got a very simple request. Please go and rate and review this podcast now on Apple if you haven't done so already. And I'll read it out next week on the show. So go and do that. Hear about your review next week. Everyone's a winner. Right, I'm going to shoot off now. Take care. Have a lovely week. See you next Friday.